This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment's Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. A mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible. Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters Wednesday, April 17th.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. It is clear from the polls that a new breed of Americans remember little to nothing of socialism as it was only a few decades ago, much less grasp its entire history. But the trajectory of socialism is really important to understand if we're to emphasize anew that socialism is a failed system that has exacted a monumental human toll. Well, my next guest lays out the history of socialism, its purveyors, and its failures in a great new book that we're going to talk about. Joshua Moravchik is a distinguished fellow at the World Affairs Institute and is here to do that with us as we discuss his book, Heaven on Earth, The Rise, Fall, and Afterlife of Socialism. Joshua, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for asking me on, Janet.
Well, I'm glad to talk about this book. It really is a great book. And you say socialism was the faith in which you were raised, which I think is a very good way to start things out. And explain a little bit, if you would, about your family background so people kind of understand where you're coming from.
Well, I'd be glad to. My parents were very devoted socialists. That was really the center of much of their lives. And they were not communists, I am happy to say. I think it would, even looking back, would be much harder for me to swallow had they been communists. They were socialists. You know, there was there were these two branches of the tree of socialism, so to speak. There were actually many, but two big ones. One were the communists and the other were the socialists. And the socialists had the good sense, at least, to not support dictatorship as the way of achieving the beautiful solve-all-problem society that they imagined. Right. But, of course, it was really quite a pipe dream. But this was their devotion, and I was kind of raised with it. And I, you know, in my teens, I joined a group called the Young People Socialist League. It also happened to be the same group I discovered that Bernie Sanders joined at one point in his evolution. Wow. And I was so involved and devoted to this that in 1968, I became the head of this group and on a national basis, and was its leader for 5 years. And then over a period of years after that, I began to really reconsider this faith as I believe it was, a kind of substitute religious faith that I had been raised with and had embraced for a time.
Right. Well, I think that when you talk about the definition of socialism, this is as good a definition as I've seen. You note that it is man's most ambitious attempt to supplant religion with a doctrine about how life ought to be lived that claimed grounding in science rather than revelation. But it's also the case that, this has taken an incredible human toll. What is it? 140 million people died under socialism in the 20th century.
Well, of course, we don't really have exact statistics on this, but a very great number were actually murdered by the regimes, and others died of disease and starvation with the famines that these regimes caused.
Yes.
And in poor countries around the world, which when they were newly independent, in the period of decolonization, they embraced different varieties of socialism, African socialism, Arab socialism, and the effect was that they didn't have any economic growth for decades. And I don't know that we have any numbers on how many people in those poor countries died and suffered because the countries were stagnating, but there was that also The trick was, if I may go on for a moment, is, Janet, there was this beautiful image that will create a whole new society in which everybody will share everything and everyone will be brothers and be no rich and no poor and all our problems will go away.
Right.
And the problem was that this was a wildly unrealistic idea. And there were some people, and I would say people like my parents, who just kept believing that somehow this nirvana would come about, and they weren't prepared to do or to support terrible things to make it come about. But there were other people who got impatient. We have this idea. It's the perfect idea. It's going to make life on Earth heavenly. And if people don't get it, we just have to use force and violence to shove it down their throats, because in the end, mankind will be better off.
Yeah.
And so they did start killing people, and they did use violence, and they went on and on and on for decades doing that. And of course, they never achieved nirvana, but they created some horrifying graveyards.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and you point out that Marx and Engels both extolled violence. So violence has been a lot of, you know, the legacy of socialism. But you also talk about the manger, I think you call it, in which this whole idea was born, was the French Revolution. And I'm wondering if you could expound a little bit on that, how it was that the French Revolution really ended up, you know, giving birth to socialism down the line.
Well, part was just in the slogan, you know, of the French Revolution, which was liberty, equality, and brotherhood, fraternité. Then the question is, well, how are you going to achieve this? How are you going to get to equality? And people start saying, well, you can't just have equality of political rights or of social status. If you want to have real equality, then you have to have complete economic equality. Hmm. And that's the core idea of socialism, is complete economic equality and all property shared. But then, of course, the French Revolution had another aspect that's less talked about, which was it wasn't just a revolution against the monarchy and against the aristocratic system, but it was also a revolution against the church.
Yes.
And the revolution was, you know, fiercely, violently anti-religious. And that also contributed to this, to socialism becoming an ideology which put itself forward as an alternative to the so-called superstitions of religion.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really important point that I do think a lot of people don't understand was part and parcel of the French Revolution. So by the time you get to Marx and Engels, you begin to have this idea of the proletarian versus the bourgeois, this whole idea that, you know, workers of the world unite, which came about later on. How did Marx and Engels really formulate what we know today as Marxism? I know there are a lot of different tentacles to all of this, but fundamentally, what do you think people need to really understand about how the French Revolution impacted the thought, particularly of Marx?
Well, above all, it excited them because it gave a model of dramatic, instantaneous, violent change. I mean, I suppose it's not fair to say that the violence is what excited them, but the idea that if you were willing to use violence, you could just completely change life on this planet from one day to the next. And so there came to be this mystique of revolution. And I think that goes to the heart of so much that's happened. If you look back over the history of the last few hundred years, overwhelmingly, revolutions have brought about terrible bloodshed and usually end up with a more repressive, worse political system than you had before, even if what you had before wasn't so good. So you had in France, you had this overthrowing the monarchy, and of course there was lots you could say against the monarchy, but the revolution ends up, after killing thousands and thousands of people, with Napoleon being crowned the emperor. So you've
Wow.
got a new monarchy except the more violent one.
That's true. Hang on just a moment. We do need to pause for a short break. We'll be back with Joshua Moravchik. His book is called Heaven on Earth. Stay with us. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today.
Hi, this is Kirk Cameron, and I am honored to be partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to help moms choose life.
Actor Kirk Cameron supports Preborn.
My four oldest children were adopted. That is because of caring and compassionate people who help those young mothers choose life. My wife is an adopted child, and her birth mother chose life for her. If it weren't for those caring individuals that help those young moms value the sacredness of life, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have my four adopted children, and the two natural born children that we have wouldn't exist either. My whole family is here because of people that are involved with ministries like Preborn.
Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford Today to support the ministry of Preborn? For $140, you can provide 5 free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide 1 ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. Think of the children in the womb this January. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. 5 free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Really important conversation I'm having with Joshua Moravchik, a distinguished fellow at the World Affairs Institute and author of Heaven on Earth, The Rise, Fall, and Afterlife of Socialism. You were making a really good point before the break, Joshua, and that was the fact that oftentimes it seems when we see revolutions come about, we see a lot of bloodshed, a lot of violence, and what comes after the revolution is not better than what they were fighting against in the first place. And that certainly has been true as you've seen the history of violence over socialism throughout, you know, all the years that even a lot of us have been alive.
It's been true again and again. Sometimes I'm a passionate American patriot, but sometimes I think we did a lot of harm to the world because our revolution in 1776 really worked out well, and it gave revolution an undeserved good name.
Yeah.
because very few others have. So I had mentioned the French, and then if you think of the Russian Revolution,
yes.
Well, of course, the czarist regime was not a very nice regime, but what came next was 1,000 times worse.
Yeah.
The czar was regarded as repressive, but the total number of people that were executed by the czarist regime over the whole century before the communists took power numbered in the dozens or scores, or you know, it was small change compared to Lenin comes in and then Stalin, and they murder millions upon millions.
Yes.
And we saw it, you know, more recent times, Janet, we saw it in Iran. A different also this mystique of revolution, that wasn't socialist, but that was Islamist, and they said that the Shah was repressive and reactionary, and there was a lot of truth to that, but the regime of Khomeini that followed was much more repressive and brutal to the people, and we look at China, we look at Cuba, just revolution is a terrible thing.
It is. Yeah, it is. Well, talk a little bit, if you would, about the Bolshevik Revolution, because that's such a significant turn in world history where Lenin, you know, the Tsar and his family were killed. And as you know, everybody knows, then the USSR was born out of that revolution. But when you talk about men like Lenin, men like Stalin, I mean, Stalin here, so many people, what was it, 20 million people killed under Stalin? And I'm sure for people like your parents, that must have been a very difficult pill to swallow. Well, we believe in socialism, but we don't believe in the violence and the dictatorship. How in the world do you look at that sort of thing and say, well, how do we justify that when we see that kind of stuff happening alongside the establishment of socialism and the enforcement of it?
Well, this was a debate that went on among socialists. Even in Russia, in the Socialist Party, there was a split. And the problem was that Marx had forecasted that the workers would get poorer and more exploited, and they would eventually rise up and overthrow the system, and that would be wonderful, and they would necessarily bring about socialism, and then we'd have this whole heaven on earth that they predicted. And then what happened is that the workers didn't do this. In fact, socialism has almost always been a philosophy of middle-class intellectuals, rather than of workers, and so the question was that the more moderate and humane people among the socialists said, "Well, all right, we need to keep bringing our propaganda or our information to the workers and explain to them why they should want socialism," but Lenin said, never mind all that. The workers aren't going to support socialism. We have to create a tight-knit revolutionary vanguard party that will overthrow capitalism and create socialism in the name of the workers, right, even though the members of our party won't mostly be workers. And the other socialists didn't accept that, but Lenin was able to pull off his coup and took power. And then from the very first moment, he proclaimed himself a dictator, and he even wrote, he was not shy about saying that that I represent the workers, and therefore it's perfectly democratic for me to be the dictator.
Right.
And then he started demanding what he called terror. We need terror, terror, terror. It was a slightly different use of the word terror than we make today when we're talking about Al-Qaeda or these terrorist groups. By terror, what he meant is the government, his newly created government, terrorizing the population so that they would submit and wouldn't rebel. And so he ordered people to be shot and people to be hanged. And he even gave out quotas, you know, shoot a lot of people, shoot 100 people there, or just to intimidate the population. And of course, then they went on from shooting hundreds to shooting thousands and then millions.
Yeah.
When you ask about what, there were lots of socialists like my parents who said, "No, no, this is all wrong. We're imagining something benign and kind and humane, and we don't support what the communists are doing." In fact, there have been all throughout the history of communism some socialists who were really in the forefront of fighting against communism. For example, the man who dreamed up the idea of NATO was the British Foreign Minister Ernest Bevin in a labor government right after World War II in Britain, and he was a socialist in the British sense. So some socialists did reject the bloodshed, but the problem was that the best socialism has done is failure. That is, the socialists who had the clear principles and decency to say, no, we don't want violence as a way to get to our goals, we'll just try to do it by legislation and by elections, they tried. And in fact, the government in Britain, for example, that Bevin was part of, in the right after World War II, led by Clement Attlee as Prime Minister, started nationalizing all the big industries in England, and within a few years, the economy just started sinking.
Yeah.
And those particular industries that they nationalized started producing less than they used to, and the socialists were shocked by that. They had imagined that once you do socialism, even and do it in the peaceful democratic way that the British Labour Party did it, that everything would become more fruitful and the industries would produce more and everybody would be happy, and it didn't work.
No,
at all.
No, and it, you know, it's interesting to me because one of the things that I've heard folks say is, you know, human beings fundamentally want to be free. And this is something that our founders understood in a way that the communists and the socialists certainly did not, especially the earlier ones. But when you look at socialism from your own perspective now, having been part of that world, would you say there's one fundamental fatal flaw, or is it a series of fatal flaws that are all equal in, you know, the fact that they just got human nature wrong, they didn't understand economics quite right? Is there one fatal flaw that really is bigger than the others when you look at the whole trajectory of socialism?
Jenna, I would say two things. The reason it failed is that it completely ignored, in its economic thought, it completely ignored incentive.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that the problem we face is not just how to divide the wealth, but how to create wealth.
Yes.
And socialism just sort of assumed that here we are sitting amidst abundance that sort of happens by itself, and all we need to do is worry about dividing it more equally. So I would say that was the flaw in the theory. But I spent a lot of time asking myself, what was the flaw that enabled this idea that originally was, you know, a kind-hearted idea to end up with the astronomical toll that socialism took of murder and bloodshed? And it seemed to me the explanation of that was the substitution of socialism for religious faith.
Yeah.
The thing here is that the biblical religions, and I think to some extent also other religions, connect some story about the universe to a moral law.
Right.
And if you want the world to be better, if you want your life to be better, your contribution to it is to govern your own behavior. How are you going to behave? How are you going to love your neighbor? Are you going to be charitable? And so on. What socialism did is said, no, we know, we have a different idea of the beautiful future in which everything will get better, and it doesn't matter how you behave as an individual.
Hmm.
There's no moral law. The only thing that matters is the politics. If we can get the right revolution or elect the right party to power or get the right legislation, then the world will become perfect, and there's no longer any demand on you, the individual, to try to behave in a righteous way.
You're right about that. And I think that's a great insight for people to consider, especially when we're looking across the spectrum today and seeing younger generations becoming more and more enthralled with the idea of socialism, not understanding all of this history that you outline in your book. And people have got to pick it up and read it. Heaven on Earth by Joshua Moravchik, who's been kind enough to join us today. Thank you so much, Joshua. It was wonderful to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me on, Janet.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you again for being here. And we'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment's Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. A mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible. Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters Wednesday, April 17th. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. This hour, Janet Mefford Today, brought to you by 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment's Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. A mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible. Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters Wednesday, April 17th. I want to talk a little bit about this House Judiciary Committee hearing that took place on H.R. 5, the Equality Act, this week. This was some incredible stuff. I probably could do about a week's worth of shows just playing some of the cuts from that thing. Unbelievable, some of the stuff that went on. But I thought it was quite interesting what was revealed and also who showed a position that made sense, who you wouldn't have expected to make a whole lot of sense on this issue. Just to go back to the basics on the Equality Act. I've talked about it sometimes, I think, ad nauseum, but I know a lot of people don't really know what this is. This was recently reintroduced in the House. This is what the LGBT activists want more than anything. This is the crown jewel right now for LGBT activists. The Equality Act, ill-named, would basically amend the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and protect people according to sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Those would become protected classes throughout the federal code. So this would affect things like employment and housing and public accommodations, and it would just do an incredible number against religious freedom. But it would also harm women in ways that even radical feminists are beginning to recognize. And that's what I want to get to. I want to start out, though, by letting Chairman Jerry Nadler, the Democrat head of this committee, talk a little bit about his thoughts on the Equality Act. Of course, he thinks it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, but he begins in his opening statement by saying that, you know, America has always been filled with bigots, and that's why we need the Equality Act. This is cut one.
All forms of discrimination are tied together, and we must address them together. If a black lesbian couple is denied housing they are otherwise qualified for, it is nearly impossible to tell if they were turned away because of their race, their gender, or their sexual orientation. It is time we make clear that none of these are acceptable forms of discrimination. We have already seen the effectiveness of non-discrimination provisions on the federal level, and we have seen how sexual orientation and gender identity protections work in the more than 20 states that have them on the books. There is no reason discrimination that is explicitly illegal in one part of the country should not be explicitly illegal in all parts of the country. The Equality Act builds on these existing protections and provides clear recourse for millions of people, no matter where they live.
All right, that sounds tremendous and everything, except let's go back to the Human Rights Campaign video that they put out, the propaganda video, and I played that not too long ago, in which they were, you know, touting the Equality Act and the need for the Equality Act. Imagine if two men try to get work and they can't get work because they're married to each other, and imagine if two lesbians can't get housing, and imagine this and imagine that. And I made the comment at the time, well, you have to imagine because it's not actually really happening in life. If you had all of these situations occurring with any sort of frequency, it would be the top headline in every single newspaper and on every single liberal website in America. Every network, MSNBC would probably do a 20-part series on the scourge and the epidemic of gay discrimination. Are you kidding me? These people run the show. They run the show. Human Rights Campaign and its Corporate Equality Index has companies from sea to shining sea completely in their clutches because they're so scared of not doing enough pro-LGBT maneuvers that they'll lose their wonderful rating on the Corporate Equality Index, and then they will be the recipients of all kinds of boycotts and threats, because that's how it works. It's boycotts, threats, death threats, and yelling and screaming. I mean, this is what goes on in the activist world. So the idea that we have these huge numbers of people being discriminated against for being gay is a joke, because nobody would dare. Are you kidding me? The only cases I've ever seen in the last several years involving somebody actually losing their job over homosexuality have involved Christian schools, where the person knew darn well what the doctrine was of the particular school, whether or not it was an evangelical Christian school or a Roman Catholic school. They knew the doctrine. They knew where the church stood. They knew what was required of them in their contract provisions. And they went ahead and violated it, and then they lost their job. Well, why is that the Christian school's problem? Why is that the Catholic school's problem? That's a problem of somebody not being upfront and not following the rules and not going along with the beliefs of the particular church that operates the school. So why is that their problem? Why is that discrimination? Well, they can't stand Christianity. That's the bottom line. They can't stand it because it's the biggest obstacle in the way to total success and total rule over everybody and everything on the issue of homosexuality and in turn transgenderism. Now, what's interesting to me is how Nadler you're going to listen to this clip. The beginning of it sounds great. And then he turns right around and negates what he just said. Listen to cut two.
The Equality Act takes special care to maintain the careful balance long established between individual liberties and our compelling interest in promoting non-discrimination. Freedom of religion is a fundamental American value, and we do not have to choose between non-discrimination and religious liberty. We have in our existing civil rights laws a roadmap on how to advance both. Religion is no excuse for discrimination, as we have long recognized when it comes to race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. And it should not be when it comes to sexual orientation or gender identity.
Okay, that's completely ridiculous. Oh, we don't have to choose between non-discrimination and religious liberty. Then why don't you afford any religious liberty protections anywhere in the Equality Act, German Nadler? Why is that missing? Because the activists know that if you have the freedom to live as a Christian, then you are going to be not able to control people in terms of moral opinion. And that's what it's about. This whole idea, religion is no excuse for discrimination. What are you kidding me? What are you kidding me? How long has the Bible been around compared to the human rights campaign? All of a sudden we have a new morality and you better go along with it because it's just like race. You know, those who've said in the African-American community, don't compare my skin to your sin. One of the greatest lines ever. Then, of course, Nadler scoffs at the idea of scaremongering and the issue of the bathrooms. This is cut three.
Many of the arguments against the Equality Act are belied by the experience of the states and localities that have protections already. The scaremongering about potential bathroom predators has not turned out to be true. Protecting the ability for a transgender person to use a facility consistent with their gender identity has not weakened public safety or criminal laws or undermined their enforcement. Similarly, protections for sexual orientation and gender identity will not force religious hospitals or nonprofits to close. New York has these protections. We have Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant hospitals and adoption agencies. And everyone, regardless of who they are or whom they love, is able to receive medically appropriate care and to be served by publicly funded organizations.
All right, let's talk about that a little bit, because when he talks about the bathroom issue not being a problem, how many times have we seen people arrested in Target alone? Google all of this stuff. Not only that, but the Daily Signal points out a case that occurred recently. There's an investigation, I think, ongoing now in Decatur, Georgia. There was a gender fluid boy who sexually assaulted a 5-year-old girl because the school allowed him to go into the girl's restroom due to his quote unquote gender fluidity. This was at an elementary school in Decatur, Georgia. Now they're investigating this. And the poor parents of the little girl ended up having to take her out of school in order to assure her safety, while the school clings on to the gender identity ideology. So I guess little 5-year-old girls potentially getting assaulted in restrooms where they're allowing boys to be. I mean, think about this. Think about this, how sick this is. Now, this is where it really becomes important for us to understand. I was struck when I was listening to this Judiciary Committee audio because I was expecting to hear a lot about the religious angle, how Christians would be, you know, affected by the Equality Act and how they would downplay on the activist side any sort of religious freedom problems whatsoever. What I was struck by, though, in the end, was the emphasis in so many instances on the issue of how women would be ill affected by the Equality Act. And it struck me anew that, hey, listen, I don't care if you get Al Capone on gangster crimes or if you get him on tax evasion, as long as you get him. So I began to think, hey, maybe that's the issue you can use to really bring this thing down in flames where it deserves to go. We'll come back with more on Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
This Easter, from 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment comes Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. When Joy Smith's son John falls through an icy Missouri lake, all hope seems lost. But a mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible.
Please, God, send your Holy Spirit to save my son.
Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters Wednesday, April 17th. Tickets and showtimes available at BreakthroughMovie.com.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
How much is one life worth? Most of us would say life is priceless, and we'd be right. After all, what is the value of someone created in the image of God? We're asking Janet Mefford Today listeners, just like you, to help us save babies through the ministry of Preborn. How does Preborn save babies? Through ultrasounds. Preborn works with hundreds of pro-life pregnancy centers across America, providing free ultrasounds for women in crisis pregnancies. And 80% of the time, when a mother sees her little baby on an ultrasound, she'll choose life. It's that easy. We need your help to support the vital work of Preborn in saving human lives. For your gift of $28, you can provide a free ultrasound to a mom in a crisis pregnancy. And for a gift of $140, you can provide 5 ultrasounds to 5 mothers. All you have to do is call 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you for saving a baby's life. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing earlier this week. Maybe you saw it on the Equality Act, H.R. 5. It's awful, by the way. You need to print this thing out from your computer and read it and give it to your pastor to read. I'm telling you, you will be shocked. Don't take my word for it, how awful it is, how ill-reasoned it is. It is a nightmare bill. And hopefully it will not pass this session because the Democrats only control the House. But folks, this is what they want. And the progressives are going to push for this as hard as they possibly can. And who knows, if they get control of Congress again and get the White House, this thing is going to become law and it's going to be a mess. Now, I go back to Chairman Jerry Nadler, who was talking at this recent committee hearing, scoffing at the idea that allowing men to participate in women's sports will ever be a problem. This is Cut 4.
Many states have sexual orientation and gender identity non-discrimination laws, and all of them still have women's sports. Arguments about transgender athletes participating in sports in accordance with their gender identity having competitive advantages have not been borne out. Sports have positive impacts on physical, social, and emotional well-being, and we should not be denying transgender athletes those opportunities simply because sometimes they may win. Nor should their occasional success be used as a roadblock to advancing civil rights legislation for LGBT people as a whole.
Okay, that's just completely ridiculous on every level. And Representative Doug Collins of Georgia, the ranking member on the committee, talked about this issue of women's sports in his response. Listen to Cut 7.
There is no doubt in my mind that men, women, and children who expend their gender dysphoria suffer deeply. Unfortunately, the legislation we're considering would harm countless people who understand themselves to be transgender and would demolish the hard-won rights of women, putting them once again at the mercy of any biological man who identifies at that any moment as a woman. The biological differences between the sexes remain scientific and certain. Men are physically stronger and faster than women, which has made it necessary for women to access clear legal protection. When any man can enter into a protected space and status is identifying as a woman, as noted by Women's Liberation Front leader, H.R. 5 nullifies women's and girls as coherent legal category worthy of civil rights protection. The bill privileges the rights of men who identify as women over biological women and girls. Consider female sports. Last year, 2 male athletes won the top 2 spots in Connecticut girls Class S indoor track meet. Female athlete Selena Soul, who finished 8th, missed an opportunity to compete in front of college coaches by 2 places. In Selena's words, we all know the outcome of the race before it even starts. It's demoralizing. Allowing men to compete against women in women's sports isn't demoralizing because female athletes like Serena aren't talented. It's demoralizing because it makes their talent irrelevant.
Boom. Exactly right. Exactly right. And you wouldn't have the same scenario on the opposite side. If you had a girl who believed she was a boy and participated in boy sports, you're not going to see a lot of that because they're not going to win. They're not going to win. In most instances, right? We all know this. This is not a sexist thing to say. Men are bigger, men are stronger, men are faster, generally speaking. So, of course, the men are going to dominate the women's sports if they enter as women. It's ridiculous. But I thought the best testimony during this committee hearing was from Julia Beck. Now, this is interesting. She's a self-described radical lesbian feminist and served on Baltimore's LGBTQ commission. She objects to H.R. 5. And listen to why. This is cut 9.
If the act passes in its current form as H.R. 5, then every right that women have fought for will cease to exist. H.R. 5 is a human rights violation. Every person in this country will lose their right to single-sex sports, shelters, grants, and loans. The law will forbid ever distinguishing between women and men. To be clear, I do support the general goal of the Equality Act, to protect people on the basis of sex, of physical and immutable biological reality, to protect sexual orientation, which is based on biological sex. I object to the inclusion of gender identity. People who call themselves transgender, non-binary, and everything in between still deserve the same basic human rights that we all do. But treating someone as if they are a member of the opposite sex is not a civil right. In fact, this violates the rights of others. People cannot change sex, no matter how many legal documents they alter, no matter how many dangerous surgeries they endure. This myth of changing sex has gained considerable traction, not only because of the synonymous use of the words sex and gender, but also because trans activism is extremely well-funded, with billionaire donors and a very deep sea of lobbyists.
There it is. It's what I've been saying for a long time. These people have the deepest of deep pockets. There are millions and millions and millions of dollars poured into this effort. The gay activists have money coming out their ears. They do. And this is a big push for these activists. So that's what's going on. And I'm glad she called them out. She also talked about how H.R. 5, the Equality Act, enshrines sex stereotypes. This is cut 10.
Sex is a vital characteristic. Gender and identity are not. Sex can never be changed, but gender changes all the time. 100 years ago, pink was a color for boys. Now pink is a girl's color. This is an example of gender. Social expectations of appearance and behavior. These expectations are based on sex stereotypes that prevent people from being their authentic selves. Unfortunately, gender identity forces people back into these stereotypical sex roles. This bill defines gender identity as actual or perceived gender-related characteristics. This is a circular definition, a logical fallacy. There is no way to protect a person on the basis of their gender identity without a legitimate definition. Lawmakers across the country will have to consider which mannerisms, hairstyles, occupations, and clothing choices make up one gender identity or another. How is this any different from the sex stereotypes women have been fighting to break free from? How is this not regressive? The concept of gender identity suggests that there is an essentially female personality or feeling that a person can have, but no such thing as a female body. Deep down, I believe you have good intentions, but gender identity only does harm.
I love that. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah, ultimately, you're denying the concept of a female body. No matter what you do surgically to yourself, if you're a man, you will remain a man. And if you are a woman, you will remain a woman. And I think that was just absolutely brilliant to bring out the point that we have sex stereotyping going here. And it's got to just gall these lesbian activists who have jumped on the bandwagon for this kind of Equality Act rhetoric. I mean, they're completely being out-argued. I love this. Then she warns about what will happen to women if this passes. This is cut 11.
Let me tell you what happens if H.R. 5 passes. Male rapists will go to women's prisons and will likely assault female inmates, as has already happened in the UK. Female survivors of rape will be unable to contest male presence in women's shelters. Men will dominate women's sports. Girls who would have taken first place will be denied scholastic opportunity. Women who use male pronouns to talk about men may be arrested, fined, and banned from social media platforms. Girls will stay home from school when they have their periods to avoid harassment by boys in mixed-sex toilets. Girls and women will no longer have a right to ask for female medical staff or intimate care providers, including elderly or disabled women who are at serious risk of sexual abuse. Female security officers will no longer have the right to refuse to perform pat-down or intimate searches of males who say they're female. And women undergoing security checks will no longer have the right to refuse having those searches performed by men claiming a feminine identity.
Yep. Brilliant stuff. Again, I'm so glad she pointed this out. I really am, because it makes so much sense and it's impossible to argue with this stuff. We all know, and I think a lot of these people who are activists know this, if you scratch beneath the surface and you really press them, they would say, yeah, of course you're a male and a female. I'm not saying there aren't some true believers out there who say there's such a thing as transgender, because there are some really empty-headed people out there, unfortunately. But I think a lot of these people who are activists would be forced to acknowledge in you know, behind closed doors, yeah, okay, we know a man is not really a woman. We know a woman can't really become a man, but we want to be, you know, equal. Okay, but you're not equal. It's not the Equality Act. You're going to destroy the equality, so-called, of women in this country and trample all over their rights. You're going to trample all over the rights of Christians and other moral people in this country who still have a moral objection to homosexuality and to all of this nonsense. They're shoving it down Americans' throats, and I just wonder at what point Americans will not allow it to happen anymore. And it better be now. It better be now, because once you cross the Rubicon on the Equality Act, you don't want to live life that way. It's going to be bad. It's going to be really bad. There was a panel, by the way, yesterday at the Heritage Foundation talking about what's going on with all of these kids and medical operations harming children, and these doctors who are now opposing the fact that wrong sex hormones such as testosterone are now being allowed to be given to girls as young as 8 years old. 8 years old. Incredible. Christian Post says medical scenarios today, such as girls as young as 13 and 14 undergoing double mastectomies and 17-year-old boys who are developmentally behind the eight ball, shall I say, because of chemical puberty blockers, are now showing up before these doctors. And these doctors are complaining about it, and they're saying this is really harmful to kids. No blood tests, no genetic testing or brain imaging scans can find a gender identity, this one doctor said, adding there's no objective test to diagnose this, yet we're giving very harmful therapies on the basis of no objective diagnosis. Right, well, the entire Equality Act stands on a flimsy foundation of you are what you believe you are. It's Gnosticism. You can't build a republic or maintain or keep a republic on Gnosticism. Let's go back to Christianity, shall we? Thanks for joining us on Janet Mefford Today. Pray for our nation. We'll see you next time.